Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
I guess it was the very first time I had experienced what that vulnerability of being on the other side of the consultation table feels like. I just wanted somebody to just listen to what my anxieties were. And everyone was like, well, you're just anxious, you're just traumatized. Here's an antidepressant, this'll fix it. And, you know, I'd never really felt the need to listen to my intuition until that point. And there was just lots of different things that happened that made me look not just at my own life, but really as to, it's kind of informed the kind of doctor I am now.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast with me, Dr. Rupi, where we discuss the most important topics and concepts in the medicinal qualities of food and lifestyle. Today's podcast is very different. It is the Doctor Dinner Party Experiment with your lifestyle doctors. Five incredible doctors who you're going to learn a lot about over the next hour. I decided to cook an entire dinner party for all of us, sat around a table. We had loads of plant-based recipes, za'atar, salads, we had roasted veggies, tahini, pomegranate, you name it. And I managed to do it all in less than an hour. And if you want to see how I did that, check it out on the YouTube channel. I'll show you how to make all those five recipes. I'm actually quite proud of myself about how I did that, so make sure you go check that out. The lifestyle doctors consist of Dr. Chintal, Dr. Vinita, Dr. Simi, Dr. Christie, and Dr. Poonam. They are a group of doctors who are passionate about helping patients and the public live healthier lives. They have a broad yet unique set of expertise between them, and they've decided to use their knowledge base to really help directly with patients by doing community groups, lots of different workshops, and you'll learn a bit about what they're up to on this pod too. They have an incredible range of specialties. Dr. Chintal is a Central London GP and trainer for Imperial College, passionate about food. Dr. Vinita is a paediatrician and nutrition specialist, and her goal is to simplify nutrition and lifestyle messages for everyday life for her patients. Dr. Sumi is an NHS GP partner and trainer in South East London with a passion for teaching lifestyle medicine, and she's also a director of Culinary Medicine UK with me. Dr. Christie is a West London GP specialising in preventative medicine, but alongside being a doctor, she's also a qualified physiotherapist and acupuncturist. And lastly, Dr. Poonam is the medical educator in Glasgow. You'll definitely be able to listen to her accent. She's also a trustee and director of the British Society of Lifestyle Medicine. You can find out more about their individual bios on the doctorskitchen.com website. And in this pod, we talk about the changing role of the general practitioner and how that's changed over the last couple of years, how they juggle family life. A lot of the doctors on the pod today have kids themselves. What actually makes a good doctor and why medicine can stifle creativity and how this is sometimes an outlet for them. Psychotherapy and counselling as a mandate for all health professionals and why we need that. We also talk about actually what it takes to be a doctor and how the label of doctor can mean anything from someone straight out of medical school to someone else with 20 years plus experience. And you'll find out exactly how much experience there is across the table with these five doctors during the pod too. We touch on the personal experiences of some of the doctors, resilience, pediatricians having the worst levels of burnout, mindfulness prescriptions, nature scripts, if giving people food prescriptions would be something that would entice behavior change, who knows? If you've ever been interested in the art of the consultation, the shared management strategy, the guiding of the consult from symptomatology to diagnosis to treatment, I think you're really going to enjoy being a fly on the wall at this dinner party. And I must say, their work in community groups, the free workshops they do, the fact that they're trying to get directly to people who won't be listening to this podcast, they won't be following us on social media, this is real game-changing stuff, and I'm honored to have these incredible doctors on the pod, and I really hope you like it. As always, you can find this information and more at thedoctorskitchen.com, but for now, enjoy the dinner. How did you guys form this little Spice Girl crew? We still haven't figured out who's who here.
Well, we all met for brunch one day, didn't we? And I looked around the table and I said, come on, girls, let's do something. We each have this interest, different interest in lifestyle medicine and different expertise. So with Chintal, she's an amazing chef as well, but creates recipes for families. We've heard what Christy does. She gets you to exercise when you've only got 1 minute or 2 minutes. And with Poonam, we've got mindfulness, meditation, stress busting, but then we have to put it all together. So we've got Sumi, who's the health coach. So how do you actually get it into your life? Because you're never going to do that unless somebody's helping you to do that.
Exactly.
It's really hard to put all these things into people's lives, and we know that because we do it every day with our patients. Mm-hmm. So we thought, why don't we do something like a platform or some events? So that's how we started.
How did we all meet though? I remember meeting you.
We met at a conference. At the College of Medicine conference, didn't we?
The Food and Medicine conference.
And I met you there as well.
And then I knew Vanita through there, so then we all met.
Yes. And then we actually came to the first culinary medicine meeting.
Oh, yeah.
Kitchen. Mm-hmm. That's the very first time we met was, you know, when you put the call out for culinary medicine?
Yeah.
This was
over 18 months ago.
Yeah.
Yes.
You're the glue.
The meeting.
So that's where we first met.
That's where we first
and
met.
Poonam and I first met in the best place ever. We met at Peggy Pochette.
Yeah, because, well, obviously I'm not from London, so I met all of you on Instagram. And then I just met you at various events. Yeah. But then also one of the other things that I do is I'm a trustee and one of the directors for the British Society of Lifestyle Medicine. So obviously being very passionate about lifestyle medicine, I kind of picked up very quickly that, you know, all of us were into the same sort of thing. And we kind of connected really over that, over various coffees and high teas and high fancy. But yeah, that's how it all came together.
Yeah. And how's that been received? Because you guys have run some events where you all speak and you essentially give your perspective on lifestyle medicine.
It's been really good, actually. We did, the first event that we did was more for families, because we realised that there's a lot of people out there who are promoting lifestyle medicine, but actually it's generally for the kind of converted already. Yeah. So we were trying to target the everyday person and the families and the children. So we had a really lovely local community hall event and it was so nice, and we had families come and their kids, and it was just really relaxed. And we did little workshops. I did a little exercise area, you did a cooking area, you talked about nutrition, and you guys did mindful eating and talking about routine. And it was so nice. It was so relaxed, and it was just a fun day. And so it was great.
I like that kind of acknowledgement that a lot of people who we speak to on social media platforms are already the converted. The mm-hmm. people that are going to actually look for healthy eating advice online are probably those who are already educated enough mm-hmm. to understand the impact of it on health outcomes. So you're essentially trying to translate that into meaningful actions for communities and people that you see on a day-to-day basis to try and interact with. Because everyone sat around this table is primary care. I mean, with the exception of yourself,
well,
Anita,
primary care community.
You're exactly so you're a pediatrician, but you're a community pediatrician. Mm. Everyone else here is general practitioners slash all the other things that you are as well.
But I think one of the biggest things that kind of connected us also, because certainly for Vinita, Chintil and myself, we're mums. So it was that kind of bringing in the family element was very important, because it's how do you actually integrate sort of your well-being and wellness into your everyday life and making it a way of life. And that's what we wanted to communicate with people, because a lot of these events tend to be focused on adults or sort of the working people, and which some of our events will be catered for, but actually we hadn't seen somewhere where you could really have an inclusive family event where children and the grown-ups and the grandparents were all getting involved and learning about how do we make a routine as a family, how do we, you know, make easy ready sort of easy meals every day, how do we factor nutrition and in our everyday lives. So I think that that was what was really lovely, and we had Daryl there, so we like brought lots of fitness and fun into the day. It was just, it was super fun. We enjoyed it so much.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And I think for all of us, I think we all feel the same. We don't feel like we've got enough time for our patients. So for a typical GP consultation is 10 minutes long. So we'd all love to spend longer going through things with our patients. And this provides that platform to really just spend time. You know, we're not rushed. Everyone has something to contribute. And the thing is, we're all in it together. We're all learning at the same time. Like, I don't think doctors profess to be having the perfect lifestyle. There's no such thing. So when we're spending a bit more time, you know, delving into our interest in prevention lifestyle, we're learning. When I was running a meditation workshop, I'm learning at the same time. I'm meditating with people who are turning up. You're going, thinking about your routine, how can you improve it? And I think doing things like that really helps us to spread that message, like, you know, beyond, you know, the realms of social media, which is, you know, really, really useful.
Yeah, I think, like, when you're working in primary care as well, you're in a very privileged position where you interact with a whole bunch of different specialties, a whole bunch of different patients with different issues, and it really is quite grounding, I find, at the same time quite overwhelming. So having that, and I think we're getting better at understanding our own vulnerabilities and our own shortcomings. Like, I don't know as much as I'd like to know about motivational interviewing and health coaching, and so I'm fascinated that you've actually done some formal sort of training in that.
I've been interested in prevention from quite early on in my career, and I think, like a lot of GPs, I felt quite frustrated that I didn't feel equipped to help my patients make the changes they wanted to. So I was really lucky. There was a Department of Health sponsored course. I applied, I got onto it, and during that course we learned the different types of conversation frameworks that you can take on with patients. So it's helping them to make the changes. So, you know, for example, I had a patient who's one of my most memorable health coaching patients. You know, he came in, but he was already quite motivated. He'd gained weight. He was worried about his, you know, risk of having heart disease because his dad had passed away from a heart attack. He was worried that, you know, he'd gained weight from, you know, sedentary lifestyle. So he said, you know, I just don't really know where to start. But previously he was someone who used to go to the gym, knew what to eat. He'd just lost his way because of family time. So I was asking him, like, you know, what one change could you make, say, tomorrow in your daily routine? So he was coming up with the answers. So it was really such a fantastic way of putting the patient back in the driver's seat. And often as GPs, we, you know, often we're doing the hard work, we're being paternalistic, saying, oh, you know, often we'll say, oh, you need to stop smoking. But actually, when you take a step back, give patients the opportunity to think about what they're doing in their daily life, they have the answers. They just need that extra sort of help to get there. So for me, health coaching has been quite transformative, and hopefully, you know, our future events will be doing a bit of group health coaching so people can think about what they've learnt at our events and then take it forward, because that's the key thing.
I have the same issue with my family, so I can tell them what to do, and I can tell them the evidence base, and I can, you know, put forward a very nicely constructed argument, but unless they come up with the answers themselves, it's very hard for them to actually make that change. And I think it's the same with patients as well. So actually putting them in the driver's seat and actually getting them to come up with the answers and everything is the ultimate.
It's the motivation for change, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
And I think one of the most powerful things as doctors, actually, well, certainly I bring this a lot to my consultations, is just being transparent. And I think sometimes just connecting with your patient and saying, do you know what? I've been there. Like, I understand how hard it is. We form bad habits so easily, but it really requires all your will and might to want to change, and helping them understand that, planting that seed. And I think as GPs, one of the core things that we have the ability to do is, if in your 10 minutes you can plant one seed for the patient to go away with, I think like that every day is just the most satisfying part of my job.
Oh, I love it.
You love planting seeds.
I do, and desk workouts.
And as GPs, I guess, as well, we see our patients multiple times. So we will see them again and we'll see how that seed has grown and we can plant another seed and, you know, it continues. So I think, you know, we only see them for a 10-minute period, but if we can just put a small change in place and then the next time we see them, it kind of grows.
I think this is why when the whole country is struggling as GPs, we're like, we love being GPs. We're like, we see change all the time. It's amazing.
Yeah, I think that's really unusual for sure, because I mean a lot of my friends who are general practitioners who are perhaps not of this mindset are facing burnout. I mean, I face burnout as well myself. And to go back to your point actually about vulnerability, there seems to be a common thread that a lot of doctors in particular who have experienced their own medical issues or have had close family members with medical issues, you understand the frustrations, you understand, you can empathize at another level. And I think that's something, there's a common thread in this table as well. I mean, I know yourself, you've had your own issues, haven't you?
I think that that's probably the turning
point.
So
that sounds really bad. You've had your own issues. You know, you've had,
my issues have you got all day. But no, absolutely. I think that for particular lifestyle medicine, it's come into many of our lives because we hit a crisis point at some point, whether it was with our own personal health and well-being or whether it was that of a loved one. And when you hit that, that's been your trigger to change. For me, certainly that was. I've faced burnout also as a partner a few years ago, but my big sort of health problems happened after the birth of my son. And that's really when, up until that point, I'd really taken my health for granted, and kind of some parallels with your health journey. But when we face a point where you think, oh my God, this can't continue, I have to change, and you start looking for ways to really turn your own life around, you then have the platform to say to your patients, listen, don't wait for that car crash moment. Which is what we often see. We see people coming in and they're getting that diagnosis of type 2 diabetes or they're post-MI, and that's when they're triggered to change. So I think just helping people prevent that point is quite valuable. So even if somebody comes in with a cold or a cough, you've got an opportunity, if you've done your consultation in 5 minutes, you've got a few minutes just to explore their social history and say, look, tell me a little bit about your physical activity levels.
Yeah. You actually opened up about your own experiences post the birth of your child. I didn't know about that, first of all. I don't think we've had that like conversation. Would you mind expanding a bit more on that and how you actually came into the understanding around lifestyle medicine?
So like I said, up until I had my wee boy, I was perfectly healthy. I'd never had any issues. But then it was really after he was born, just post delivery, I ended up with a very big blood loss. And then in trying to kind of resuscitate that blood loss, I ended up having quite a severe reaction to the blood products, which then led to DIC. My heart stopped, I went into heart failure, overwhelming sepsis, and just really everything kind of transcended into a point where I was in intensive care, ventilated. So it was quite tragic. Yeah. And then the aftermath of that was the healing took so long. I was not just physically depleted, but just emotionally and mentally was just completely drained. And everybody around me was just trying to medicalize it. And I think when you have that medical knowledge also, it's hard to switch off. Mm-hmm. And I guess it was the very first time I had experienced what that vulnerability of being on the other side of the consultation table feels like. I just wanted somebody to just listen to what my anxieties were. And everyone was like, well, you're just anxious, you're just traumatized, here's an antidepressant, this will fix it. And, you know, I'd never really felt the need to listen to my intuition until that point. And there was just lots of different things that happened that made me look not just at my own life, but really as to, it's kind of informed the kind of doctor I am now. But at that point, I had to kind of take my own health into my own hands. So I kind of started looking at meditation and mindfulness and really started working on my own physical activity levels and getting myself a bit more active, eating better, not just for me, but wanting to incorporate that into my son, because I was like, well, we're Asian, so already he's doomed. Looking at my family history, gosh, we're all doomed. What can I do to kind of prevent as much as I can some of the things that may happen to him when he's in his 30s, 40s? So really that was my big motivation to start looking at wellness.
I think it's interesting though, isn't it? Because as medics, we're all taught, you know, what's the diagnosis, spot the diagnosis, what is the etiology, what is the treatment plan? And we're not taught that sometimes the treatment is just listening. And as general practitioners, as people in primary care, you're very well aware of how just the connection, just being listened to, is treatment in itself. And you kind of have to sometimes, I mean, I've learned this throughout my GP training, is to withhold that prescription pad because you're like, oh, I'm meant to give an antidepressant in this case, or the patient is wanting some sort of medical treatment, as in a pharmaceutical, whereas actually the right treatment, in some cases, not all cases, but in a lot of cases that I see, is to not give a pill, to not give an intervention in that respect.
I think we've gone too far the other way. I think that, I mean, definitely we all practice evidence-based medicine, but I think that in sort of traditional medicine, we're really taught to focus, like you say, on what is the diagnosis, what is the treatment, and it's usually in some sort of intervention. But actually, much of the intervention is holistic. There's so many other things involved, and most of us, it kind of took a moment in our life to kind of get to that point where we're like, actually, this prescription pad, we can put so much more on there. So I tend to prescribe, like I give out gratitude journals to my patients. And I feel that patients sometimes just want something. So on a normal NHS prescription, I will write down sometimes, you know, I want you to just do some breathing exercises for 7 days. And they love taking that away because we're living in a society that is so informed. People are clued up, but they want to be given the option. And sometimes when it comes from a doctor, they're like, yes, I'll listen to that.
And sometimes I actually write on a piece of paper, I'm prescribing for you today. And I'll write 10 minutes out in nature, go for a walk at lunchtime, you know, and take some time for yourself. And they really love it, don't they? They like taking that piece of paper away, and it's so satisfying.
But we underestimate how powerful our voice is. And that interaction with the patient is often half of the management, the treatment. They go away feeling a different person.
Absolutely. The therapeutic consultation is just sitting and listening. I think Chintal and I, we're both GP trainers, and I think the way...
For the listeners, can you explain what that actually means?
Yeah,
actually?
Sure.
So I think we assume sometimes
we're assuming
everyone knows the NHS structure. I think a lot of people don't realise the difference between a doctor, someone who's fully qualified in a specialist position, someone who's a junior, they just think, oh, all doctors are the same, you're all the same, but actually there are multiple levels of specialization and different specialties as well.
So just for anyone who doesn't know what it takes to, say, become a GP, we all have to do 2 years of foundation training, so spend a couple of years in hospital training, and GP training at the moment is 3 years long, so you spend 2 years rotating around different hospital specialties, you know, be it paediatrics, obstetrics and gynaecology, women's health, mental health, because as a GP, you're essentially expected to be a jack of all trades. So having experience in all those fields is, you know, really, really important. And a lot of the training by the time they come to you in primary care, which is what I do at the moment, so I have a final year GP trainee with me, is just learning the art of the consultation. So being able to, you know, sit with your patient for 10 minutes and go through that journey from symptom to diagnosis and a shared management strategy. So I think GP training has changed over the years. I think previously it was quite paternalistic. So for my dad was a GP, and in, you know, in his day it was very much like you would just tell your patient what to do and they say yes, doctor.
I didn't realise your dad was a GP.
Yeah, my dad was a GP as well. Yeah, and it was interesting because I briefly worked with my dad, and it was really interesting. So
is he telling you what to do?
Yeah, and so then I'd have a lot of his regular patients like, you're quite different to the way your dad is. Your dad would just tell us that, you know, you're carrying a bit of extra weight, you need to lose weight. So that was, you know, that's how it used to be. Whereas I think now, I think particularly with my health coaching, how I think the direction and the way that we consult is quite different. I think we want to be shared with our patients. We want to empower them and all listen to them and not necessarily reach for a prescription pad because we know that's not necessarily the right thing. And actually, if you go back to medical school, first line often was lifestyle, but it's almost along the way we've forgotten because, you know, pharmaceuticals have told us, you know, prescribe this medication. So I think things are changing. I think GP trainers now, the ones who are supervising, are really trying to get that message through to trainees. And I'm certainly seeing that the appetite to learn that way of doing things is there, which is really refreshing. So I can see the future GPs really sort of channeling that message that we're all really keen on.
I was just going to say that I found with the GP trainees that I have, also usually ST3, so in their final year of GP training, They don't actually have that much training in lifestyle medicine during. Mm-hmm. And when they come to us in general practice, it's really refreshing to actually, you know, put it into practice with patients. Because actually, when you answer an exam, even then, the first treatment plan is actually lifestyle changes, isn't it? That we're taught in medical school.
Yeah.
But weirdly, whenever we put it into practice, it's always a prescription. Yeah. So I think
it's quicker, isn't it? It's always was quicker to say, oh, I'll write this prescription. But if you can just sit back and pause and actually use the beauty of continuity and bring your patients back, it's quite interesting what can happen.
Do you think there's a type of patient that actually wants to be told very directly?
Definitely.
Yeah.
How do you sift those out? I mean, we can be very honest here, but it doesn't work for everyone. The soft approach sometimes doesn't work, and sometimes people do want to be told, but that, I suppose, comes with a lot of experience. I mean, I'm learning every time I'm in general practice, mostly emergency medicine these days, but I'm learning different consultation skills from peers as well as my own interactions.
Yeah, I think it comes after years, doesn't it? Yeah. I mean, we sat and thought about how many years we have between us of medical experience.
Guess how many years there are between
Between the five of us.
How many?
Yeah. Go on, Rupi.
I don't know. You all look so young, so I'm going to say five.
Very good answer.
You just qualified. It looks so fresh-faced. Yeah.
So it's over 70 years of experience. So
I wouldn't have guessed that.
Yep, there
we
you
have
go.
A lot of experience between us.
Yeah. Must be the lifestyle.
So that's but yeah, good food.
To be honest, we have to be flexible, don't you? You know, not everyone's going to receive.
Just being responsive to what the person in front of you seems to want.
Absolutely.
I think that's what's beautiful, is that you get to see all walks of life. You get to see humanity in all of its kind of ways. And I think that you really only get that when you are in general practice, because you're not seeing the same type of person or the same organ or the same disease every single day. You just never know what's coming through the door, and you get really good at just reading not just the verbal cues but reading the non-verbal cues, and you get to know your patients over a lifetime. You get to learn about the intricacies and dynamics of families, and you get to know, like, how is this person going to respond? And you get good at people reading.
You do. Yeah.
It's great, though. That's what I love about it.
Yeah.
I really do.
It's so exciting.
It is really exciting. It's the most exciting thing.
I think you have to be a bit nosy, don't you?
You have to
be quite comfortable. I mean, I think I honed my skills of nosiness when I was doing sexual health in Brighton, which is a wonderful place to do sexual health. It's great. I mean, the stuff that I heard, and, you know, I had to Google a lot, actually, whilst I was there. Yeah, I had no idea what people were saying to me.
Examples.
Well, I don't think... it's correct.
We're
dinner
all friends
table.
Here.
If this wasn't a dinner party, then I wouldn't mind. But maybe a bit later after I've had another one.
You should
come
and do a gum clinic in Glasgow.
Oh, well, well. But you have to obviously ask them lots of questions.
Yeah.
Are you heterosexual? Are you homosexual? Are you bi? Do you use protection? Mm-hmm. How often? How many partners? You know, all these different things that, I mean, I would go really red. My first time I had started doing that. Yeah. But now, reel it off.
Don't think anything off it.
And I think people can read the confidence that you have as a practitioner.
Yeah.
And so it just definitely comes with experience. I mean, I probably, hopefully, will look at myself in 10 years' time and think, you know, I still feel very junior, if I'm honest. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I've learned so much in the next 10 years.
Yeah.
And it's a real, like, ongoing, continuous journey.
It's really funny when you say that about how you, like, talk to patients, like, just this morning as well. Like, you know, if you, especially as a female, I'd imagine it's the same when you see, like, female patients as a male. But, you know, like, just doing something like a digital rectal examination on a man, and I came out with, an examination of the back passage for things like hemorrhoids and other things.
We're
going
to talk about hemorrhoids over the
dinner
table.
It's fine. Yeah, exactly. Ain't nothing you not seen.
We're being very polite because we're faced by mics, but in reality...
This is very normal.
No, it'd be very normal.
It gets way darker.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just kind of, I came out with, don't be worried. I do this all the time. I mean, not all the time.
but like sometimes, and then it was just this kind of complete awkwardness, and you're like, oh my god, I've just dug myself a hole.
But I think you're right. I think you're right there. You know about going in there confidently. I think if you take out the awkwardness for the patient, they really appreciate it. So I think if you can say, listen, if you say, actually, this part of your body is no different to another part to me, I know it is for you. I often find people just go, oh, okay, doctor. And also, because we're so short on time, we unfortunately, we don't have that time to take, actually, I'll give you a few minutes just to say, sorry, can you please undress and we can just carry on. But I think if you're confident, patients really feel that. And it's important to give them that, you know, sense that, you know, it's no different to any other body part. Because I think the work you did with the Eva pill was really helpful, because you were bringing, you know, forward the importance of, you know, using terminology, talking about genitalia. It's no different to any other body part. And I think the more the public are seeing things like that, I think it makes it easier, even in our GP consultations.
Absolutely, yeah. So. And the Eva pill, just for the listeners, is the charity that tries to raise awareness of the 5 gynecological cancers. And I remember when they first asked me to do that, because the CEO, Athena, who she saw me do a lecture. It was one of the first lectures I'd done. It was all about menstrual pain, heavy bleeding, and what sort of nutritional strategies we could advise patients based on the evidence that we have for patients undergoing this, alongside obviously treatments that we all know of as general practitioners. And she said it was the first time that A, she's heard a man talk about this subject, but B, without really, you know, going red or like becoming embarrassed and stuff, because I mean, as GPs, we do this all the time.
Absolutely. But there's always you know, to be honest, our jobs are quite hard and we see quite a lot of stuff. So obviously we don't want to make fun of anything, but actually to have a bit of humour in your life and your job is good, isn't it? You need to have that healthy balance, don't you?
So. We were talking about it today, actually, resilience, particularly in paediatricians, because apparently at the moment they're the highest number of doctors seeking help for mental health issues.
Really?
So I've been working with one of the previous presidents of the Royal College to say, okay, how can we help our doctors? So obviously GPs, they do seek help, but paediatricians aren't that good. And we all need to know ways to build resilience. And they were saying they're only just getting it into the medical student curriculum. And now they're going to put it in the paediatric.
Absolutely. I mean, they're probably as stressed as most specialties, but then they have to deal with children. I mean, that is going to be harrowing itself.
It is stressful. And with all the high-profile cases.
Exactly, really. So the GABA case.
So many people have dropped out of training.
I can imagine.
We're really short of
well, my primary interest was I wanted to be a neonatologist. And throughout uni, that was like every SSM, so specialist study module I did was geared towards that. That was all I ever wanted to do. And then I did my first job in peds and we had a little baby that died and I just could not emotionally deal with that. And then I think it just becomes worse. It's hard enough now as a GP sometimes when you have young babies coming in and they're sick and you just think, how do I disconnect myself? Because you become really emotionally attached, and it's about
really
keeping that in check.
Once you've had your own children.
Oh, absolutely.
Really, I'm a much better paediatrician. If somebody tells me they've been up all night with a vomiting child, I understood what that meant once I'd had my own child doing that. And then that's just a different dynamic with the mums and parents.
I feel like sometimes that hinders my ability to connect with someone, because I've had that experience as well. And even though I've assessed the child, they're safe to go home, they're tolerating some fluids, obviously they're not 100% better, obviously they're still sick. Often the question comes up, well, if you had children, you would know. And they always ask me, do you have children? And I have to be honest, the only children I have are godsons and they live in Miami. And I do get worried phone calls from their mother and father all the time. But that is something that I haven't experienced. And then I probably can't empathize as much. I mean, that isn't to say that everyone needs to have kids to be able to do their job. No. But, you know, it is certainly.
Your own experience changes you, doesn't it?
I think for the patient as well, that immediately the way that their rapport with you changes and they open up, and it's just a very, I've noticed since I've had children, when I see a patient with children, that just the way they speak to me is very different. And I think
because they know
you can relate
for certain things.
Exactly,
even sort of feeding difficulties prior to having my little boy, if a mum came in and was anxious over colic, I'd be like, it's colic, you didn't sleep, okay, I mean, babies cry, you know. And then my little boy had silent reflux, which was undiagnosed, and I wasn't taken seriously.
until he actually ended up really sick with it. But that sleep deprivation was horrific, probably worse than the birth. That dealing with a baby that is having severe colic and heartburn and it's helpless, like, I would never want to go through that again. But now when mums come in or parents come in and they talk about sleeplessness or, you know, colic or reflux, and you just completely, like, empathise. Yeah. And even though you can't necessarily, you can help them to a degree, but you can reassure them that it does get better. I promise you, your child will eat properly at some point. But just being able to have that human connection. But equally, we've got ageing parents at home. We've all had either siblings or friends who have been unwell. Like, you can see narratives that are parallel to your own life as a GP with your patients. And I think if you bring that human element every day to work with you and promise to deliver that to your patients, but be able to also disconnect when you leave, I think that that's probably what makes a good doctor, irrespective of what specialty you are.
I think everyone needs psychotherapy who's in medicine. I mean,
it would help.
I think it would definitely help. I mean, one of my friends is an A&E doctor in Australia, and he's a registrar level now going towards consultancy, which is really weird because he's a little bit younger than me, and we were working together in A&E at the same time. But he's great. He was telling me about a particularly traumatic night where he was in charge of the ED department. He had a whole bunch of juniors with him. He had some really, really severe casualties come in, young RTAs, road traffic accidents. And at 7 in the morning, at the end of this horrific night, there were 3 therapists running around the ward going and trying to pin down the juniors that were on over that night and just have a conversation with
them.
And the A&E consultant, even though he wasn't on, was calling the department at 7 in the morning to speak with him and all the other juniors one by one. It's something that's so lacking, I think, in the NHS, which is already overstretched. And I'm sure they are in Australia just as much, or getting to that level anyway. But certainly something I think that it needs to be in. It almost needs to be mandated in the NHS, I think.
I mean, good practice is that you have a debrief, but even that doesn't necessarily happen.
No.
But they're making sure it's happening now in Evelina with the Children's Hospital, but only just now.
There is access, though, for doctors to get therapy, and it is out there. You just have to access it.
I think
it
within general practice training, actually, we're quite good at that. That is something that we have at the PSU, the Professional Support Unit, to support any trainees in difficulty. And while they're training, not afterwards, actually, but during their training, the deanery actually has a lot in place to support and to help build resilience and to... Yeah, but I think
it should be mandatory.
But it should be mandatory for everybody.
It should
and
be
all specialities. Yeah,
I think what's good. I think there is more help out there than there was before, and I think as trainers,
and it's more acceptable to ask for help.
I think
as well.
So.
Before, I don't think it was.
I think you're right. I think there's still an element of stigma associated with asking for help amongst the medical profession. I think it's shifting, but I think it's still there because of the professional responsibilities we have. Doctors worry if they, you know, ask for help.
Yeah.
Is their, you know, competency going to be questioned? So I think it needs to be normalised more, like you said. I think the fact that in Australia that's actually had to be done, that would not happen in the UK. Mm-hmm. Whether it's resource or culture, it's not quite there yet. But I am reassured that, say, for example, general practice in London, if there are any doctors listening, there's something called the Practitioner Health Programme. Yeah. So you can self-refer... if you have any, you know, distressing issues in your life, regardless of whether it's to do with work or to do with, you know, something that's happened outside of work, support is there. So I think that's some great work going on.
I think the very fact that, like, we as GPs and primary care physicians all sat around the table speaking on a public podcast talking about these issues, I don't think would have happened like a few years ago. You know, the openness to be vulnerable, I think, is something that, yes, is becoming quite fashionable, if I'm honest, but at the same time is something that would be very, very looked down upon amongst medics themselves. I mean, I remember the very first time I had an atrial fibrillation episode, the reason why it took so long to even talk to my boss about it was because I felt like I might be seen as a weakling. And I think that's just kind of endemic in the culture, but it is changing.
It is changing. But I think it's interesting because now, I think because of the high rates of burnout, say primary care physicians and now paediatricians as well, people are adopting portfolio careers because they're recognising that working, you know, the hours that people previously used to do, it's not sustainable. So I think doctors want to do other things using their medical backgrounds. to deliver, you know, the message in a different way, work with patients in other ways, which is, I think, what a lot of us are doing now, particularly around this table, I think, as a way to manage that.
Well, it's nice to have an outlet, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, creative outlets and things,
One of the reason, actually, that I ended up in the whole portfolio route, I was previously a partner and was quite burnt out with it, and I think I probably entered that quite early on in my career as a GP, but also there was quite a lot of pressure put on partners. But the light bulb...
Just expand on that a bit, actually, because I don't think many people understand why GPs are burnt out in the first place, because the perspective is, and perhaps amongst medics still as well, that GPs just see the patients in the morning, the afternoon, they go home, they're usually on the golf course by 3 p.m. That was the traditional, honestly, people still think that about GPs. Oh, you're a GP, you must be on a load of money and you go to the golf course. Yeah. No.
It's absolutely not the case. And I think if I was ever to redo a career based on money, I would definitely not have chosen general practice or doctor, full stop. But when I was a partner, and I mean, Sumi, you're still your partner, but it wasn't just seeing the patient. So you'd have your usual GP day. So you'd been seeing something in excess of 30 face-to-face patients. You'd have your home visits. You'd have your usual admin. But then on top of that, you had all the business side to look at. So you had to see where you're meeting all your deadlines, meeting all the contract requirements. If you didn't have a staff member turn up for the day, how are you going to cope with that? You have internal politics and dynamics also. So it's kind of like entering a marriage with other partners, so you all really need to be connected and on the same wavelength, which is hard enough to actually find a soulmate in real life, let alone like be financially tied to other people who may not work like you or may not have the same outlook in terms of business. So a lot of these things are quite stressful. If a partner goes off sick, for example, you've all got to kind of cover that. So the pressures are insane. And of course, you're managing and juggling your own personal life alongside that. And for me, I had my baby at the time was only 1 year old. So I was trying to juggle that. I was working 4.5 days a week. But there was a time where I was sitting on holiday with like my friends in Turkey, a cocktail in one hand and ordering toilet roll on the other hand for the health centre, because we didn't have a practice manager. I was like, is this my life, you know? Like, do I want luxury toilet paper for, like, you know? And it was little things like that that it got to a point I thought, this is encroaching on everything. I was working late at night in order to get away at a reasonable time to spend time with my family. I was having remote access, which means GPs often take a lot of their paperwork home so that they can do it later on in their own personal time. But you can be up to all hours of the night, really never disconnecting. So I kind of felt that after 3.5 years, I just couldn't stand that. But the light bulb moment for me in my portfolio journey was I work for the University of Glasgow. So I'm a lecturer and also a tutor. But I was interviewing sixth year medical school students. And it was like every student was coming in and I was like, tell me, why do you want to be a doctor? And they were like, I want to help people. But I'm also like grade A celloist and I've just traveled to Uganda to do all this other like voluntary work. And I'm, you know, amazing at sports. And I was like, once upon a time, this was like all of me. And now I literally sit and order toilet paper and see patients. But it was just this complete diverse individual full of creative flair, but also academically successful. And I thought, why is it that we somewhere along the line give up all of that creativity when actually we're full of that? And for me, going down my portfolio journey was, hold on, I love writing. I want to write more. And since then, I have kind of gone on to kind of do more in sort of journalism. But, you know, there's lots more to me than just being a standard GP every single day. And that was my journey into portfolio. It was like young students that inspired that. And now as a teacher, I tend to say to them, never give up your other interests, you know, and medicine very much informs absolutely every one of my other passions. But it's not all of me.
I'm noticing that amongst different specialties as well. So I think it's not just GPs that have like these amazing outlets. It's a whole bunch of different specialties. I mean, this is one in pediatrics, but endocrinologists, a good friend of ours, Anita, is a gynecologist. You know, there's so much that a lot of other medics can give. But one thing I did want to ask you guys about is lifestyle medicine as a term under attack?
Yes.
Yes.
I would say so.
Yeah.
I guess it's how you view it. Lifestyle medicine, for me as a GP, as an NHS GP that practices NHS evidence-based medicine, is an adjunct to my everyday practice. So I wouldn't necessarily say that it's a replacement in every clinical scenario, but it's definitely going to be an adjunct and definitely help patients in a positive way, whichever aspect of it we use for particular conditions. And I think that's the whole point. Nothing in medicine is black and white, and you know, lifestyle medicine isn't black and white. So I think the way it's attacked is probably very black and white. And we perhaps need to see the wider picture.
I agree with Chintal.
Sorry, I was just going to say, at the end of the day, we're just empowering patients to take control of their own health, aren't we? So we're just trying to say, you've got the tools there to be able to optimise your health. And we're just giving them the information and trying to motivate them to make some changes, which will overall help their health physically and mentally. So it's just empowering, I think, to be able to offer them that opportunity.
And I think the term lifestyle medicine, I think doctors have been practicing lifestyle medicine for eons. It's just a different term. If you speak to a GP from 20, 30 years ago, it's like, oh yeah, we're talking about sleep, prevention, exercising, moving. This is not new. I think what's interesting is it's been given this new name. It's getting a focus, which I think is overall, despite any negative press, I think it's a fantastic thing. Because I think in many ways, if we focus on it, we're going to be giving our NHS, you know, a bit of a lift. We're going to be, you know, hopefully, you know, preventing chronic diseases and, you know, the burden that comes with it, both financially in terms of quality of life and life expectancy. So I think it's just a new term for something that doctors do anyway, and they do it well, but I think it's bringing the focus back onto prevention and looking at yourself as, you know, someone who can help themselves with their own health.
And it's also, it's not replacing medicine, is it?
No,
it's just as you said, it's an adjunct, isn't it? It's not replacing.
It's an addition too.
Yeah, we all prescribe stuff. Everyone needs to be prescribed things in certain conditions. But we're just saying also, alongside this, we can also give you the opportunity to improve your health in other ways. So it all should meld together, shouldn't it? Yes. It should all work together.
And I think all of us are evidence-based. We all, you know, we read the journals, we know what's out there, we know our nice guidelines. And absolutely, we are so fortunate to have some of the medications and drugs that we have now that we didn't have yesterday. And it's about using them appropriately, but also giving patients a chance, if they can go without medication, to try the different areas of lifestyle medicine. And that's really, I think, the message that we want to put forward.
And at the same time, they could have a drug for a particular condition, but they could be helped with lifestyle medicine in another way for another condition. Mm-hmm. So it's using it together with medicine.
I think the traditional role of the doctor was just to treat illness. But actually, I don't think that there was much focus historically on sort of health promotion and education, which actually is the traditional role of the doctor. We're not just there, especially as GPs, to just treat illness. We're there to actually educate our communities, which we've not done. Historically, we've never had the time. And right now, I think lifestyle medicine is seen as a threat to a lot of GPs that feel burnt out or feel that already there's so much on our plates. So here is another thing that we have to do. I think that there's often an attack that lifestyle medicine is just a bit of woo-woo and it's just quackery medicine. But actually, we're all doing it. We're all practicing it. But the facts are that society is getting sicker. We have more chronic disease today and we have more awareness of it than we've ever had. So clearly, education is not getting out there. It's not got out there through the media. It's not got through all the other avenues and outlets. So maybe now doctors need to be at the forefront of this message and campaign to say, we want to actually start moving towards a healthier society. Absolutely. It starts with us. Yeah. And that's what lifestyle medicine is.
And that's what prompted us really to start our workshops, because actually we didn't have the time in our clinical hours to address these additional things that people could do to improve their life. And by holding these workshops, which we deliberately promoted and targeted within the community, within our practices, to actually reach people that didn't have access to social media, that weren't already converted.
Yeah. We handed out flyers to the church halls and to our community. It was
schools.
Amazing.
Yeah, schools and our local libraries. GP practices.
Exactly.
We wanted to reach that target audience that perhaps don't really understand it and educate them on different aspects of their health and how they can improve it.
Mm. What do you see that is the future for the your lifestyle doctors? Have you done that, like 5-year forward sort of thinking, or what you envisage?
No.
Why don't we do it?
That's
right,
a good
now?
Idea.
Like, how are you going to scale this? Because I think, like, a lot of people will look at what you guys are doing, and I'm playing devil's advocate, and say that's all very nice, but how is that actually going to make a difference on a grander scale, and how are you going to measure it as well as you can get this funded? I obviously am a big believer in it, and I think there's a lot more in the way of how we can actually quantify benefits to human health. But I think that's one of the main criticisms, that, you know, there isn't enough infrastructure around our healthcare system to deal with, you know, the kind of things that you're doing, which are quite labor intensive. I mean, you're giving up your own time to do this stuff. And
to be honest, I mean, at the moment, I think we're just focusing on trying to reach as many people as possible. So we want to do some more events. We're planning on doing an event in February.
First of February. Brilliant. Okay.
Yeah, we'll save the date, because we're going to do... In the first event, we targeted families, and that was really successful. This time, we thought we would try and target more working professionals, because pretty much all of us, I think, have experienced some form of burnout in our lives, and we're all learning from it. And so we want to try and share some of our experiences to working professionals. So we thought our next event might be geared towards the young professionals, of any age, to be honest. Any age, not exclusive, not exclusive. And so we want to try and give people the opportunity to improve their, or optimise their health, really, through making some lifestyle changes. And we really want to be able to give people, let people leave with like a social prescription, like we were talking about before. We actually want people to take a piece of paper away and have written down tips and tricks that they've taken from our workshops. Because we've all, as we said at the beginning, like we've all got our own little niches. And so we'd hope that, you know, if people are already exercising and eating well, then maybe they need to look into stress and avoiding burnout. So they might take something away about mindfulness, for example, or routine. But if someone's already doing all of that and they don't know how to exercise, then hopefully they'll take something away from that, and they'll be able to take it away on a piece of paper and have their own little social prescription for themselves. So that's what our aim is for our next event.
Awesome. That's super cool.
But it's always about creating that ripple effect.
Yeah.
You can reach even like sort of on a day-to-day, we reach, you know, even individuals. They go away, and if something has resonated, they tell their friends or their family members, and people start that. So our focus is that if we can continue with, through content making, through event organising, and through really just pushing forward our message, that we can hopefully create a bit more of a ripple and a movement.
Absolutely.
That, you know, we're just ordinary people that happen to have some information and knowledge and experience.
And I guess sort of scaling up, where you say a long-term plan, you know, if other people were to be inspired by that and set up their own groups and set up similar things in other areas, that would be amazing.
Amazing.
Which, you know, we would love. So if we can make this work and we can show that it works, maybe it will inspire others in other areas to do the same.
It could be like the park run model.
Yeah.
Like if you had like
exactly.
a kind of structure to what you guys are doing, and then people can come along and start their own sort of lifestyle events up in another country. That's really how you start a movement. So big fan of you guys.
Aww,
of course, of course. I mean, I haven't cooked a massive meal like this for everyone.
We are honoured.
Do you often have five women over for dinner?
I know, yeah. It's going to look really bad on social media, isn't it? Rupi, Doctor's Kitchen, Liz, five women to his studio. Low
this
lighting.
This is where we put the PIMP tune that
dropped. Yes. She hasn't had a glass of wine.
But I must say, your food is pure dead brilliant.
Oh, thank you very much. That's very nice of you. I very much appreciate it. If you're going to leave the listeners with one tip from your respective area of lifestyle, and I'm going to limit you guys to a sentence because we can all talk ages. We'll start off with sporty lifestyle medicine spice.
Thanks. So my main tip for everybody out there, and because I'm an advocate of exercise, I'm going to ask everyone to move more and sit less.
Like it.
I will.
We should have been standing up for this. Sorry.
Standing desk.
I think it's actually more important how you eat than what you're eating sometimes. Yeah. And this sort of social sitting where we're all around a table, it's not there in many families, and that's what we try and encourage people to go back to. Because whatever you're eating, you end up eating in a more mindful way.
Yeah.
So that's really important.
I always say it's as important who's around the table as well as what's on the table.
Yeah.
I guess following on from what you've just said, my angle is the cooking and putting things into practice. Mm. I would say to try and do that as much as a family or with your partner or with other people, and talk about what you're doing and encourage conversations around food, why you might be cooking a certain ingredient, perhaps go shopping together, perhaps cook meals together, encourage family. As a mum, I'm a big advocate of including my children in everything that we do, and from the kind of choosing to the shopping to the cooking process, you know, they're part of it all. And I really think that encourages really healthy conversations around food. So that would be my point.
I love it. So I would say that no matter how overwhelming your day gets, always remember to breathe, to focus on every breath, and the most important thing is to always enjoy every breath.
Okay. Well, last but not least, no pressure here to come up with something really phenomenal.
Are you posh lifestyle medicine spice?
I'll take that. I don't know if that's a compliment or not, but thanks.
Well, you're very fashionable. You can start your own line, you
know. Thanks, Ruby. So, in terms of all the things we've said, I think for anyone who's listening, who's inspired by what we said, or they're sitting at home thinking, you know, I really want to make a change in my lifestyle. Firstly, just, you know, don't be too hard on yourself if things are not going exactly the way you want it to. You're human. It's hard to get things exactly right. But maybe think about one area of your lifestyle that you'd like to improve that would have the most impact. Take something, maybe think about one small change you can make just that one, just for one day, and then just try it out, you know. And if you can maintain that, you'll be surprised how far you'll get. Because I think often as human beings, we can have big ambitions, say, for example, New Year, to make some massive changes. And then when we don't succeed, we give up. So I think if you're thinking about making a change, you know, give yourself some time, give yourself an opportunity, and then see how you go. And if you want some more support, you know, you can see your GP, enlist your friends and families, you know, come to workshops like ours, and hopefully you'll be on a journey to better health.
That is the longest sentence ever.
I really, really enjoyed that, and I can't wait to have more dinner parties, but I would love to know your opinion as to whether you enjoyed that or not. Please give us your honest opinion on Twitter, on Instagram, send us a DM as well across social media. I'll try and look out for them. You can send us an email too via the website. And if you want to have more of those, please do let us know. I'd love to know who you want on the podcast or who you think should be at the next Doctor's Kitchen dinner party. Love to know. Please send us your comments. As always, you can find all of this information and more on thedoctorskitchen.com. Please follow my guests on social media. They are at Your Lifestyle Doctors, and you can find their individual social handles on thedoctorskitchen.com podcast page as well. I'm really excited for them. I think they've got an incredible set of future goals, and I can't wait to support them as much as possible. Please give us a 5-star review. Over 1,000 of you have already. I really, really appreciate all of them, and I try and read all the comments. But if you haven't, we know thousands of you listen to this podcast every single week, so please consider giving us a 5-star review. It really helps spread the message. Have a fantastic week, and I'll see you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.